Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin. On today's show... We've got a packed show for you this week, listener. So much so, in fact, that we're going to start with a short list of the stories that could have filled an entire episode, including border police beating a Knesset member during an anti-occupation protest in East Jerusalem. There's also the embarrassing story of how a senior defense official, unaware that an elite military operation behind enemy lines had been postponed, sent details of said operation to the foreign media 24 hours before it happened. We also won't have time to discuss the decision not to award the Israel Prize to Professor Oded Goldreich over his alleged support of the BDS movement, something he, of course, denies. Instead, we'll be discussing the ongoing Netanyahu corruption trial, including the fallout from 3 days of testimony by one of the prosecution's key witnesses, as well as the Gordian knot that is Israeli coalition politics, Iran, Palestinian refugees, and whatever else we can fit in. So joining me today from the beating heart of Haaretz's newsroom, assignment chief and US news editor Amir Tibon. How are you, Amir?
Hi, Simon. So good to hear your voice again.
And yours. Joining us from Washington, we've got Haaretz's North America correspondent, Ben Samuels. Welcome to the pod, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Are you keeping well over there in the swamp?
You know, one day at a time.
So, guys, there's a lot on the agenda today, but I want to start with you, Amir, and your experience working for Sarah Netanyahu. I'll read that again. Your experience working for the Walla News website. You were diplomatic correspondent for Walla for 3 years, right?
Yes, correct.
And it now finds itself slap bang in the center of the Netanyahu corruption trial.
Well, you know, we were at the center of the corruption, allegedly, when it happened. Now we just got to the trial.
And everything is coming out in the open. The former Walla CEO's testimony ring true to you?
Yes. The things that Iran Yeshua, the former CEO of the Walla website, which we should say was for many years the most read website in Israel, the most accessed, very popular news website, the things that he told on the witness stand last week in the opening testimony in the Netanyahu trial were very familiar, a bit painful to hear, and not surprising at all to anyone who worked at Walla in those years like I did.
What kind of stories was he telling that were so familiar to you?
Well, he spoke for several hours every day for 3 consecutive days giving his testimony about what he had to do as the CEO of this very large and popular news website that slowly becomes from an independent news source into a tool for the, allegedly, for the owners of the website, the Elovich family, very rich couple, which were the owners of Bezeq, the largest telecommunications company in Israel, a tool in their arsenal in an attempt to improve their relationships with Netanyahu as the prime minister. Basically, the bribe deal, allegedly, that the prosecution is saying took place is that Elovich asked Netanyahu for favorable regulation that was worth a lot of money to him, perhaps hundreds of millions of shekels. And in return, he pressured Ilan Yeshua, the CEO of Walla, to turn the website from an objective news source into a website that carries favor with the Netanyahu family and progresses their agenda.
Something that's worth more than money, perhaps, for Netanyahu. Did you experience any direct interference in your work, Amir?
Many times, unfortunately. This was an ongoing process. It's important to explain. It was not like one day the website turned from a normal news organization into a propaganda outlet for Netanyahu. I would say there were highs and lows. There were times when it was terrible. It could have been going on for weeks at a time, when we as the journalists were under a lot of pressure and censorship, and we could not get actual work done. We could not report the news items that were critical towards the prime minister were censored, erased, downplayed.
Actual news items rather than analysis or comment?
Everything combined. And then after a while, maybe we would leak what was going on into competing news outlets. If you recall, Simon, there was a huge investigation in Haaretz in 2015 by Gidi Weitz, our colleague, who wrote a very extensive report about this. And every time the story would come out in bits and pieces, it would get a little better for a while, maybe because the people who were directing this effort, the Alovich family and Ilan Yeshua, got a little scared. And they would, you know, unleash it a little bit and give the journalists freedom to work. And then we would have a good time for a few weeks or months. But then it would regress again, and they would go back to the old habits of trying to serve the Netanyahu's. And eventually what happened is that Ilan Yeshua, as this process was going, he recorded all of his phone calls with the Alovich couple and saved all of the WhatsApp messages with them. And these are now the evidence that the prosecution is using to put the Alovich couple together with Netanyahu on trial for bribery.
Mm. Amir, as diplomatic correspondent, you were writing about very sensitive issues and at a very sensitive time. You were in Washington when Netanyahu, for example, addressed both houses of Congress against the Iran nuclear deal and when Obama failed to block UN Resolution 2334. Tell us about trying to cover that for Walla.
Well, again, these were exactly the junctions where you would feel the pressure come down. And it was around issues like Iran, but sometimes even about much smaller things. I remember one time traveling with Netanyahu to the United States in 2015, not when he spoke to Congress, but a few months later, I think he addressed the United Nations. And while we were in New York with the prime minister, there were terror attacks happening in Israel. It was a bloody weekend with several stabbing attacks. And I wanted to report about the fact that the prime minister's orbit seemed at loss and didn't really know what they were going to do to handle the situation. And there was a discussion if he should cut short his visit in the mm-hmm. United States, come back early to Israel. And instead, I saw that there was a news item published with my name on it, basically attacking Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, who were ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet at the time, and his rivals from the right wing. And I called my editors in Israel to say, what is going on here? And they told me there was pressure from above, and literally above is the management floor in the building of Walla, to put up a news item attacking Bennett and Shaked. And to me, this was a terrible situation. Instead of being able to report what's really happening, my name is being signed to some basically attack on the prime minister's political rivals. I asked to withdraw my name from it, but the news item itself remained. Mm-hmm. This is what, you know, was happening. Instead of looking for solutions, there was an attempt to use Walla to attack political rivals.
For the sake of fairness, what's the situation at Walla now?
I can't say for sure. I've been at Haaretz for more than 4 years now. Basically, I left Walla at the end of 2016 when I felt that all hope was lost of improving the situation. And I have to say that for me and many of the journalists who worked there at the time, we fought and we tried to make it better. We tried to leak stories to other newspapers in order to put pressure on the management. We tried, even when we were told there is no way to publish critical stuff, we would still send in critical articles and news items that were not seen favorably by the prime minister's orbit. And we tried to fight the good fight. But I don't know what has happened there since I left. I have heard that things improved dramatically at some point, that there was much more press freedom. Some of my friends who remain there said that things really got better after everything came out into the light and it became public. And I hope that it stays that way. And I think there is an important lesson here, not just about Walla as a website, but about Netanyahu and his toxic relationship with the media. Because, Simon, it's not only this corruption case. All of the three corruption cases that Netanyahu is facing trial for right now have to do with relationships that were allegedly corrupt with business tycoons who own media companies in Israel. This is one case with the Alovich family and Bezek in Walla. The other case, Case 2000, with Noni Moses, the owner of Yediot Acharonot, which for many years was the largest newspaper in the country. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then there is the case with Arnon Milchen, with all the gifts that he allegedly showered on the Netanyahu family. And he also had a lot of investments and involvement in the media arena in Israel. And this is the important issue here. More than what story was deleted or not from Walla, we are seeing here a real trend of a prime minister who is trying to get access and control of the media in ways that, according to the state prosecution, involved corruption.
You said you quit at the end of 2016, when all hope was lost. Not coincidentally, I think that was also just after the Trump triumph. Did Wallace stump for Trump as much as Bibi did? Was that part of the game?
I can tell you that in one of the correspondences that emerged as evidence in this trial between Ilan Yeshua and Iris Alovich, the wife of Shaul Alovich, and you know, this is the couple that basically, the family that owned Bezek and Walla, Ilan Yeshua at some point proposed to send me to the United States to write about what was happening over there. And she wrote back that my articles from there would be annoying. I don't know what that means. Maybe they thought that I would write about the fact that, you know, that Trump represents only half of the United States and that there is another half as well, and about Israel's relationship with the Democratic Party and the Jewish community. But she shot down that idea because my articles would be annoying. So, you know, we would never get to know, Simon, how she would have seen my coverage of Trump. But it's okay. I got to do it for hours and it was more fun.
I think for journalists, if we're not pissing somebody off, we're not doing our job.
I tend to agree.
So, guys, since this isn't supposed to be a true crime podcast, shall we move on to our bread and butter? Let's talk about the racists, the fascists, and the homophobes. You guys co-wrote a piece about American reactions to the success of the Religious Zionism Party in last month's election, from within the Jewish organizations and from Jewish politicians. Ben, who's spoken out and who's remained silent?
So, you know, your left-wing organizations have obviously sounded the alarm just because all of these racist, homophobic comments have been so antithetical to their worldview. But the major Jewish institutional organizations have been traditionally very reluctant to criticize the Israeli government, and the rise of these, you know, unabashed racists really puts them in a position where they don't want to find themselves. So some organizations have voiced specific concerns about their potential role in the governing coalition, while others have decried, you know, very specific statements made, but there hasn't been, you know, an outspoken, unequivocal rejection of these parties and anything they may touch that you would hope to see or even expect to see if this sort of situation was in a country other than Israel.
What about the administration itself? Any dissatisfied noises coming from that direction?
So the administration tends to avoid commenting on political machinations before they're actually formed. You know, I think it's been a very apt description of the Biden administration so far that they are taking an approach of do no harm when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They are very much focused on slowly unwinding things done by the Trump administration rather than pushing the ball forward in a very significant way. So I wouldn't expect them to issue any strong condemnations of this in the immediate future.
I mean, you mentioned the undoing everything that that Trump has done. Part of that is resuming U.S. support of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Work Agency. You feel that there's something more profound afoot than just undoing what Trump did?
Well, I think there's been a general disappointment from certain wings of the American population that Biden and his administration hasn't taken a more proactive approach to engaging in this conflict. But I think it's been telegraphed from a very early stage, you know, since he was elected even, that he was going to approach this from a very pragmatic point. He wasn't going to appoint a peace envoy. He wasn't going to launch any flashy final status negotiations. And I mean, part of that is just due to where his priorities are. And now, you know, he's focused on COVID. He's focused on the economy, Russia, Iran, China. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict just isn't high up on his agenda. And beyond that, I think he has a very realistic view on how likely it is that he would be able to make any progress based on the facts on the ground at the moment. So I think Biden resuming aid to the Palestinians is this sort of, you know, small, tangible achievement that can be made where it actually makes lives for people on the ground better without sacrificing any political capital.
Amir, the moves on Iran seem to fit into that category too, right? He's taking things very cautiously.
Yes, but I think on Iran, there is at least a very clear sense of direction of where they want to go. I think what you can learn from Ben's excellent reporting on these issues on the Palestinian stuff is that it's really, really limited in scope. And we're not sure if it's part of a broader policy or if it's just about, you know, making things better on the ground and keeping the status quo. Whereas on Iran, we do see a clear direction of wanting at the end of the day to have a new agreement and to have something that is more grandiose in a way, to get a new Iran deal that would replace the old one and to bring a sense of maybe a new relationship between the United States and Iran. I'm not sure we're seeing that kind of ambition on the Palestinian issue.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin became the first Biden official to visit Israel on Sunday. He met with Defense Minister Benny Gantz, who told him that Israel wouldn't stop lobbying against what it sees as a dangerous nuclear deal with Iran. And at the same time, there's all kinds of reports about cyber attacks, maritime attacks, who knows what else. What's going on that front?
Well, it seems that the Israeli commitment to basically not being committed to the new Iran deal is more than just words. We heard Netanyahu declare it last week in a speech that was giving on Holocaust Remembrance Day, and he got a lot of criticism for the timing of the speech and for making it political. But the one important message from that speech was that Israel doesn't see itself, you know, binded in any way to this new agreement that is being cooked. And so I think you could even look at some of these events and wonder if it is an attempt to sabotage the negotiations. We're not hearing that explicitly from any Israeli officials. But again, the timing here is pretty clear that whatever is happening in Vienna and in these virtual Zoom talks that might be happening between the Iran and the world powers, Israel is not going to change its operational plans because of that.
Ben, does Biden have Washington's support on pursuing a deal with Iran? Is there much kickback?
So, you know, I think it's important to sort of add to Amir's point just now that, you know, there is a difference in how the Biden administration is approaching this compared to the Obama administration, in that, you know, Israel's concerns are being accounted for more so than perhaps was believed that it was being done under the Obama administration. So Tony Blinken has spoken with Gabi Ashkenazi, his Israeli counterpart, more than any other foreign secretary to date. And the National Security Advisor has spoken with his counterpart, and obviously Lloyd Austin's in Israel right now. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the main concerns in Congress from both parties is that Israel's concerns in terms of Iran's malign regional behavior would not be properly accounted for. So I think the fact that the administration at least is demonstrating that they recognize this concern, I think, is going a long way. There has been a bit of an effort from the anti-original JCPOA crowd to sort of scuttle anything related to that deal. You know, there was a big backlash against Colin Cowell, who was a senior Defense Department nominee. He was also a senior official in terms of negotiating the original deal, and there was a big pushback against his nomination that didn't really go anywhere. There was a letter that AIPAC lobbied for that had about 43, I think it was, signatures on it compared to 60 signatures based on the original deal. So in terms of opposition, you know, there is opposition, but it's not as robust as one would think.
And certainly not as robust as the opposition in Israel. Ben, I was reading just before we came on air your interview with Jeremy Ben-Ami of J Street. And I know we're accustomed to asking about how AIPAC responds to U.S.-Israel matters. Maybe we should start turning our attention to J Street from reading your interview, which I don't think has been published yet. That's an organization that finds itself in rather rude health of late.
Yeah, I mean, they are about to hold their 12th annual conference, and they really find themselves in uncharted waters. So, you know, they were founded toward the beginning of the Obama administration and the end of the Bush administration. And they've really evolved from, you know, spunky upstart to voice of the opposition during Trump. And now they find themselves perhaps as representing the majority voice in the majority party in Washington. So now the question is, how far can they push Congress to fight for the policies that they deem necessary, and whether they convince the administration that they have the political space to be more proactive relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
How do they plan to exert that influence?
So this year's conference is mainly going to focus on how to better define the uses to which American assistance can be placed. So they're going to be urging Congress to include language in the fiscal year 2022 appropriations package to apply a universal standard that all countries, not just Israel, but all countries should ensure that no U.S.-provided funds are being used to help annex or exercise permanent control over areas that are subject to military occupation. So it's important to clarify that they're not calling to condition aid, and they remain 100% supportive of providing Israel with the aid promised under the 10-year MOU signed by Obama. But they think it's very vital that people should know how this money was used and how it will be used.
Amira, a resurgent J Street wouldn't exactly fit in well with the kind of government that we're likely to get here in Israel, right? And it's another sign of the growing rift between the two communities.
First of all, I have to say, as the assignments editor, that Ben's article is already live, and I encourage.
Excuse me, I will link to it in the program notes. I apologize.
All good. And I encourage the readers to find it and read it. Excellent interview. And yes, actually, one of the issues that Ben and Jeremy discussed is the difference between the direction in which the American Jewish community is going on the one hand and Israeli politics on the other hand. Because whatever government we get here in Israel, it will tilt towards the right. The main question is, will it be a Netanyahu ultra-Orthodox, far-right government, but, you know, here comes the tricky part, with some cooperation with the Islamists, which will be a first of a kind, or will it be a center-right government in some weird cooperation between Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett at the top? And there will be representation for the left-wing parties as well in this government, but the right-wing will be the more dominant force. And so in either a government, or if we go to a fifth election and then, and you know, Netanyahu remains as caretaker prime minister for a few more months, it's still clear that overall the politics here in Israel is trending more to the right on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, whereas the American Jewish community on these issues is moving slowly more to the left. It's not that J Street is right now the most powerful organization. I think AIPAC is still strong in the game, but it is getting more powerful. And the trend lines are clear. We've known them for a while. And we have to, this is one of the things we write about so much here at the Aretz. And for the state of Israel, it is a strategic challenge.
So I guess that the Jewish organizations like ourselves will have to wait before passing judgment to see what kind of government we get, and whether it's a right wing with Islamists, as you say, or a right wing with the Netanyahu. Guys, I think that's all we have time for this week. It's been much fun, as always. Thank you, Amir.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you to Ben.
It was a pleasure.
And thank you to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.